Hey, good morning, everybody. And see, we're tuning in here. Welcome to Enlightened Radio, and thank you for hooking in today. This is John Case, and you're about to launch onto a somewhat updated version here of the Moose Turd Cafe, which because of my advanced age, I have moved to 7 a.m. instead of 6:30. And some people keep telling me it's just too early at 6:30. I'm good with that. Anyway, today we're going to try something a little different. The Moose Turd Cafe comes from a classic tune by Utah Fellows, which I'm going to play here in a minute if I can get my my stuff together. The moose turd, I can say shit, right? Get my moose turds together here. if I can, I'm going to give you the source of the Moose Turd Cafe. And it's a great story by Utah Phillips about a job he had run for the Santa Fe Railroad, in which, you know, one of the challenges, of course, was finding a cook, because you were lots of places out on the line, and you had a team of people, and no one was going to hire a full-time cook, so somebody on the team had to cook. And some of these fellows weren't that good a cook, and they didn't want to cook, probably because they didn't get paid as much as they were cooking. But somebody had to cook, or nobody ate. Anyway, this led to the incidents we now speak of, which is the Moose Turd Cafe. And although I think it's in Utah Phillips' original thing, it's the Moose Turd Pie is a confection that he decided to make at some point. And I'm going to turn on my, I'll make sure I'm turned on here. I think I am. And we're going to give a little intro here this morning by playing, of course, Utah Phillips, a great little story here. Let's see if it's going to record. Okay. Yes, welcome to the Moose Turd Cafe. November the 5th. Oh, that's the wrong one. I apologize for that. I'm going to search for it again. Let's, as you can see, Moose Turd Cap, Moose Turd Pie. That's what we want. We don't want the recording of the old show, do we? And here we go.
Went down and got a job with the rural electrification in the Navajo Indian Reservation, running electric power lines into all the Navajo outhouses. Was one of the first people to wire ahead for a reservation. Finally, I'll tell you about the worst job I ever had in my life. Worst job I ever had in my life was working for the Santa Fe Railroad south of Las Vegas, Nevada. Yeah, that's the old Mormon Muddy Mission, you see. It's way out in what the Navajos call the boonies. Out in the desert. Now, the job was Gandhi dancing. Now, Gandhi dancing used to be in the old days. Gandhi dancing was when the Irish were building the railroad. Of course, the first transcontinental railroad was built by Irish laborers. And they used these long-handled shovels called Irish banjos that were made by the Gandhi Shovel Company of Chicago. Now, the Irish laborer would take the wide end of the shovel when he could find it, and he would jam it in under a rail or a tie, and he would climb out on the long handle, do a little jig step out there, and that would lever the tie up or the rail up, and you push gravel in underneath it and tamp it down, and that levels the roadbed. See, that's what Gandhi dancing is. Leveling the roadbed so the damn train doesn't fall off as it goes by, which is just a big drag for everybody. Now, they don't do Gandhi dancing the normal way anymore, see, like they did in the old days. Nowadays, they run three cars out on the line. They run a box car out there that's a bunk car. You sleep in it, got bunks in there 18 inches apart. And then you got a tool car with your tamping irons and your tongs and your double jack hammers and spikes and all of that equipment, see, to do the job. And then you got a cook car. I mean, there's no restaurants anyplace around, so you got a cook car. Pots and pans and a coal or wood-burning stove and a long table down the middle to eat at. Only thing they don't hire is a cook. That's because they're cheap. Saves them money. Rule is that in that crew, they're supposed to pick among their own members who's going to be the cook. Now, they don't try to do it sensibly, like draw lots or decide who the best cook is. What they do is they wait and find out who bitches and whines and pisses and moans the most about the cooking. And they say, all right, wise guy, you think you can do better, you get to be the cook. Well, that was me, see? Old alligator mouth. The new man on the crew, and that was the worst food I'd ever had. I mean, it was dog bottom pie and pheasant sweat. Otter water comes out of an otter. It's a terrible, terrible stuff. Some people might think it's a delicacy, but I thought it was garp. So I complained, and they said, all right, wise guy, you get to be the cook. That made me mad, because I didn't want to cook. But I knew if anybody complained about my cooking, that they were going to have to cook. Armed with that knowledge, I sallied forth over the muddy river. I was walking around among the cheat grass and bunch grass there, and I looked down, and there was just a hell of a big moose turd. Biggest damn moose turd, that was a real steamer, damn. I looked down at that meadow wafer, and I said to myself, self, I'm gonna bake up a big moose turd pie. Cause if anybody complains about my cooking, they're gonna have to cook. So I tipped that pasture pastry up on edge. I got my shit together, so to speak. And I started rolling it down toward the old cook car. Bloom, bloom. I got it down there and leaned it up against the side, and I climbed up in the cook car and I baked up a hell of a big pie shell. And I baked that moose turd in it as slick as you please. And I crimped the edges with my thumbs and laid strips of dough across it and garnished it with a sprig of parsley, a little paprika. It was beautiful. Poetry on a plate. And I served it for dessert, waiting for the first hint of a complaint. Well, this giant dude come in, about 5'40", I mean, he was big, throwed himself down like a fool on the stool, picked up his fork, took a big bite of that moose turd pie. Well, he threw down his fork, and he let out a beller, and he yelled, "My God, that's moose turd pie!" It's good, though.
Well, there you have a little bit of moose turd pie, the origin of the cafe. I figure if you have a little moose turd pie, nothing worse will happen to us the rest of the day. And, of course, in these times, that might be something you need to get through the day. Anyway, welcome here. We're going to move on here now to a one of the latest updates from Richard Wolff, an economist, left-wing economist out of the New School, and I think he's got his own gig now in New York City, and he's, I guess he's one of the surviving Marxist economists who's not, there are some others, but, you know, some of them are, have a distance from reality disease, but nonetheless, the crisis in our, I call it a crisis, in our economic system, mainly reflected in the, we can't do anything about inequality attitude, is causing people to look for answers in, of course, old and new places. And, of course, one of the things that always gets revisited every time somebody's unhappy with capitalism is the work of Karl Marx. And I've known a lot of Marxists in my time. Not very many of them read much of Marx, and not many of them were very thoughts that were very actually close to those that Marx actually did. And it's one of those interesting things that happens to people who write works that, in their time, have a big impact. And Certainly, Marx's works had a big impact. They had a big impact on the worldwide labor movement. It had a huge impact, of course, in the last time that capitalism went through one of these Gilded Age catastrophes. We seem to be headed in that direction again. But of course, that's one of the subjects of Richard Wolff's presentation. He does a weekly podcast, and he does a good job, actually, and he's a very reasonable guy, talking from a perspective that you don't always hear much, and he knows what he's talking about. He's not a fool at all. He's a real economist, not, you know, a fake one. There's a lot of fake ones. So we're going to take up about a half hour here on the program, maybe 35 minutes, listening to Richard Wolff's podcast, Richard Wolff's presentation. And I encourage you to get a hold of him. You can find him on the web. Just search for Economic Update and Richard Wolff, W-O-L-F-E, and you can find an entire library of his stuff. And I plan on publicizing it a little bit because I think he's pretty reliably good. Also going to hear from my friends at the Democratic Socialists of America. They have a podcast called Belabored. And maybe we'll hear from some voices of some teachers this morning, too, as part of keeping track with the West Virginia teacher strike, which is underway right now and started on Thursday, basically. You know, whether it's a strike or not is a little different. It's a walkout. Actually, the superintendents are cooperating and closing the schools. It's because the issues at stake are really affecting all state employees, including superintendents and their staff, as well as other public employees working in almost every aspect of public life, except, I think, cities or towns. I think everybody's covered under the same benefit package in the state, whether you're working for the county or working directly for the state, and or for the universities, state universities. So you have, and of course, the public school infrastructure as well. So the teachers are taking the lead here. They've been taking pay cuts effectively for 3 to 4 years now, mainly due to a combination of rises in what they have to pay for their insurance. And then what they have to pay for their insurance has risen because the state's constitutional obligation to fund the public employees and insurance, is it agency or association? I'm quite sure. You know, ever since the Republicans have taken charge here, and gotten stronger. That is, you know, they lie all the time so much. But one of the big lies was, is we love education, and then they, you know, kick the teachers in the ass. You know, it's you have a situation in West Virginia where the teachers don't make enough to send their kids to college. Most teachers don't. Now, if you can't send your kid to college, that means your kid can't be a teacher either. And then that's part of this disinvestment in humans that live in West Virginia at the expense of these natural resource and other interests that's taking place. And that's, you know, destroying the state. But anyway, we're going to hear, let's go into, here we go, and get the, there we go. Listen to Economic Update here.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, incomes, debts, jobs, for ourselves, for us in the future, for our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and my hope is that that prepared me well to present to you each week this analysis of some of the major events in the economic lives we lead. I want to begin this program by thanking various hosts that I have visited during the month of February 2018. I want to start with the Chapo Trap House. They did a really wonderful interview that was lively and interesting. And for those of you who know the important work that they do, Chapo Trap House, take a look. You might find the interview they did with us as exciting and interesting as we found it. I also want to thank the people in Praxis Peace, a local group in Sonoma, California, on the other side of the country. And they were our hosts when we spoke, Dr. Harriet Fraud, who often appears on this program, and myself, at the Sonoma Community Center. And finally, I want to thank KPFA, the Pacifica station in the Bay Area of California, where I returned in order to do the annual fundraiser at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley, as I have done every year for the last quite a few. It's a wonderful experience for me to meet the very people that I try to reach, the people who hear me on the radio and then want to kind of have a in-person and close-up interaction. Just want to let you know, it's as interesting and exciting to me as it is, I hope, to all of you. So let's jump into the economic updates for our time. You must have noticed, as I have, that every time the capitalist political economy that we live in, an enterprise-driven economic system of stores, factories, and offices on the one hand, and the government, which is dependent on those enterprises for much of its revenue and for the economy to keep going, without which there wouldn't be much toleration for the political system either. And you must have noticed, as I have, that when that economic system breaks down, the place where almost everyone turns real quickly to solve the problem is to the government. That's what happened in the 1930s when we took a real dive. It's what happened again in the bailouts that came right after the crash of 2008. So isn't it interesting that the very corporate leaders who turn to the government to save them when their system doesn't work turn around and blame the government as if it were the source of all the problems rather than them? Of course, it's very clever, right? Because if we are all afflicted by unemployment and all the difficulties of a capitalist system, it would be dangerous for the people who actually run it if they were the targets of our upset. So it's important to have a scapegoat, to make somebody else do it. And the government has been the scapegoat of choice for right-wingers and for people who love capitalism and cannot get their heads around the idea that it's a system with a lot of problems. Nothing illustrates this more than the fishing industry. That's right, something we don't talk about very often, but we need to. Fishing is a dying industry. Not long ago we outfished freshwater, but now we have done what a few years ago would have been thought impossible. We have literally destroyed ocean fishing as well. We've overfished. We've fished in unsustainable ways. Why? Because fishing companies, here we go now, have profit as the bottom line. Fishing companies are competing with one another all the time. It makes no sense for one fishing company to hold back on grabbing all the fish it can, because if it does, it only creates the business for a competitor. So in that kind of a situation, if you let the private enterprise system go, it will do what it has now done. Fished out the oceans, made fish difficult, made fish often scarce, made fish too expensive for many people to afford, and to literally make them disappear. What we have is a failure to use the government to control the failure of the private fishing industry. It's a cautionary tale about how capitalism works. The second economic update for today has to do with malls. That's right, those either beautiful or hideous collections of stores that we all know about, especially here in the United States. And as I have been telling you in recent broadcasts, huge numbers, thousands of malls are empty now. Weeds are growing up through the asphalt of the parking lot. People don't go anymore. Other uses are being examined for the empty stores that haven't been able to find a tenant for years now. But I was interested to learn in a recent Bloomberg story that some malls are doing just fine. I want to mention some of them to you. the Americana Manhasset, wealthy North Shore of New York's Long Island, the Forum Shops at Caesars in Las Vegas, the Grove Mall in Los Angeles, and perhaps the most elegant of them all, the Bal Harbor Shops in Bal Harbor, Florida. They're doing great. They're expanding. They're cramming more stores into their space. They're renovating to make it even more elegant and attractive to consumers and to local wealthy people. What's remarkable is you often don't have to go more than, a 10-minute drive from one of these malls to see one of the other kind of malls. Bal Harbor, it's literally the mall at 163rd Street, just up the road, which can show you the abandoned mall, the dead mall. In other words, what we're seeing is a mirror to our economy. A tiny number of high-paid, high-priced malls doing very well in an economy that has made the rich richer. And the vast majority of malls that serve the rest of us are dying. As I say, it's a mirror, but it's a mirror with a certain poetic way of teaching us something. And to show you how profound the mirror is, let me tell you about the most recent expansion of the Bal Harbor Shops Mall. It turns out that right behind the mall was a 70-year-old Congregational church, right behind the parking lot. It had a famous large sign called Worship This Sunday, the sign for the Church by the Sea, as it was called. Wow. Recent months, the mall purchased the church, purchased the land on which the church sits, and has torn down the church to make room for more wealthy expenditures by the wealthy people who enjoy the wealthy Bal Harbor Shops Mall. There's something even more poetic about the elimination of a church so that the wealthy can have yet more in the way of an expensive mall. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum for our third economic update. And here I'm indebted to Matt Brunig of the People's Policy Project. They do interesting economic analysis there, and I found this one particularly interesting. Using the Survey of Consumer Finances, a very important government document giving data about our economy, Matt Brunig calculated young families. He took a look at families with heads of the family below the age of 35 years. And he said, I want to look at the young people of America and ask what their situation is. How much wealth do they have? What's their situation? What can we say about them as a particular group? And what he found was so arresting for me that I want to share it with you. He looked into the net worth of these families. The net worth basically means you add up the assets that such families have and you subtract from that the debts they have to see how much their net worth is, what they own less what they owe. And he made a further decision. He excluded vehicles, because vehicles lose their value very quickly and so really aren't part of what you ought to think of as a family's wealth. Okay, 2016, what was the net worth, the median net worth of young families, families below 35 years of age for the head of the family? Well, as I say, this blew my mind. Median means 50% of the families have more than this net worth I'm about to tell you about, and 50% have less. So the median net worth of young families in America in 2016, not counting their vehicles, was, here we go, $1,250. That's what the median. Half the young families of America have less than $1,250. What does that mean? It means that young people have no fallback, nothing to see them through an unexpected expense, a sick child, a lost job, a divorce, you name it, all the things that life can throw at you. Half the young families have $1,250 or less to cope with all of that. Nothing better gets across the lack of a recovery in the United States since 2008, or the failure of a capitalist economic system to provide for the young people that are going to be our future and the children they're bringing into the world, than to tell us, as Mr. Bruning's work has done, what they're living on. I've also told you in past broadcasts about the bizarre decisions in the state of Kansas, where they cut taxes on business drastically, they cut taxes on the rich drastically, and promised the people of Kansas, the Republican governor did, Mr. Brownback, that by doing this cutting of taxes, they would stimulate the economy of Kansas and provide lots of more jobs, and with the people having more jobs, they'd pay more taxes, and the government would be in great shape. Those were the promises. None of that came to pass. Kansas did not undo its unemployment. It has had higher unemployment than most other states in the United States. None of the good things happened. I now want to tell you about a state really nearby, Oklahoma. Oklahoma, very like Kansas, governed by a Republican conservative who cuts taxes. And here are some of the consequences of the cut taxes. By the way, cut taxes particularly for the fracking companies, the oil and gas companies that are the only part of the Oklahoma economy not in deep trouble, and even they have had a rough few years. Oklahoma has taken things to a stage that I need to talk to you about because it is so severe. Here's the first thing. In many parts of the state of Oklahoma, they have cut the length of the school week from 5 days to four. The weekend in these places continues through Monday. Why? Because they don't have enough money, they say, to pay school teachers. And the salaries they offer, among the lowest in the United States, very few states offer as little as Oklahoma. The only perks they can give to their teachers for paying them so little is to give them a day off. Let me take that a little bit further with you, if you don't mind. What do the teachers do on the Monday they don't have to go to school? It turns out they have jobs to fill in their income. Half of them, roughly, work at Walmarts, and the other half in local restaurants. Oh. And what happens to the families whose kids don't go to school on Monday? Well, they just have to make do in whatever way they can. Did that solve the state's problem? No, it turns out it didn't. It turns out that even if you don't make someone work on Monday, giving them a chance to go get paid at Walmart, which has some of the lowest pay scales in the United States, or at a local restaurant, and that doesn't pay well most of the time either, particularly in Midwestern states like Oklahoma, that you're still paying your teachers, even with that, way too little. And guess what? Which should surprise nobody. Teachers who aren't in overabundance in America don't want to teach in Oklahoma. So they have a shortage despite having shortened the work week for the school kids and the teachers. And how have they handled that? You'll love this. I'll have to read it to you. The shortage of teachers in the school districts have found, here we go now, 1,850 adults without the necessary qualifications who have been given emergency certifications and placed in classrooms. Penny Risley, the principal of an elementary school in Wagoner, Oklahoma, said to the media, "This year, I emergency certified my secretary." As an economist, I am required to teach in every university I've ever been that the future and well-being of the American economy in the world depends above all else on the quality and the quantity of educated young people that enter the labor market. For us to be responding to the current economic situation by savagely cutting the quality and the quantity of teaching we do to our young people is the equivalent in economics of shooting yourself in the foot. It is irrational. It is damaging in a way that cannot be repaired for the tens of thousands of young people in Oklahoma going through this kind of experience. It's actually a kind of a stunning demonstration, and it needs some explanation. And here's how it works. When the capitalist economic system gets itself into difficulty with economic downturns of the sort, for example, we had in 2008, and which are regular occurrences with a capitalist economy, something has to happen. And what typically happens is that we turn to the government, as I pointed out earlier, and we ask the government to help people out as they suffer with unemployment, with cut work weeks for their kids' schools, and all the other outflow of economic troubles. And then we often see Democrats, liberals, come into office because they're the ones who push the government should help out. But of course, the Republicans and the business community don't want the government to do too much for fear that everybody will get the idea, maybe we should have the government do more. Maybe the government should prevent these collapses from happening in the first place. So they hold everything back. So the Democrats who try to do something can't do very much because they don't challenge the system. They just try to get a few things done. They're held back. And eventually people say, gee, these Democrats are not doing enough for us. And in their anger, they go back to the Republicans. Great, say the Republicans. The real problem is the government. Let us starve the beast. Let us cut the taxes so the government doesn't do all the bad things it does. So they cut the government, which then, what? Throws people back into suffering, deregulates what businesses can do, leading us into the next economic downturn where we repeat the whole game. So we get a politics, which is America. Oscillation between the Republicans for a while until they blow it up. Then we give it to the Democrats for a while until they can't deliver what it is they promised. Then we angrily go back to the Republicans. That's all Mr. Trump is. He's the latest wave in this oscillation. And guess what the Democrats are doing? Waiting for him to cause so much difficulty, so much disruption, so much suffering that there'll be a wave the other way in one of the next elections. We're not solving our problems this way. We're just kicking the can down the road as we oscillate back and forth. Before I continue, I want to remind you that we maintain two websites that we invite you to make use of. They're open 24/7. They have no charge attached to your using them. One is rdwolf with two Fs.com. And the other one is Democracy at Work. That's all one word, democracyatwork.info. Both of these websites allow you to communicate to us and tell us what you like and don't like about this program. Both of these websites allow you, with a click of a mouse, to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And for those of you that listen to this program as a radio show or a podcast, if you're interested in seeing it as a television program, we invite you to go to patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, patreon.com /economic update, the name of this program, and you can see it as a television program. We maintain and update these websites. They're for you. They're a way for you to partner with us, to share what we provide in the way of analysis and information with other people, and that's exactly what we try to do. You can do that too, and then we will proceed and be twice as effective as we might otherwise be if we went separately. Okay, let me turn next to a place in the world that I go to nowadays because they are crafting new initiatives. And so once again, I'm in Great Britain. And once again, I want to talk to you about the British Labour Party. They're sort of the rough equivalent of the Democrats over there. And this time I want to talk to you about one of their leaders, not the one who gets all the attention, Jeremy Corbyn, but rather one of his close associates, John McDonnell. He's announced a plan. He says that the people will be better served, the British people, with their water needs, their energy needs, their rail systems. He proposes that these are not working real well. They're overpriced by the private companies that run them. They're not well maintained, sometimes not even safe, and we can do better than private capitalist enterprises. What does he propose? Classic. And what's interesting is not that he proposes something new, because this isn't new, but that it's becoming very popular in Britain, which is why the polls there show that if there were an election today, the Labour Party would win. He proposes the renationalization of water, energy, and rail in Great Britain. The government is going to take them over, and he explains in public speeches it will cost nothing. Here's how it works. Right now, he says, the water company, just to take them as an example, a private company, borrows lots of money, provides water to the British people, and charges the British people for the water enough money to pay the cost of delivering the water, to pay the cost of the money borrowed to do all of it, the interest charges, and on top of that, a profit distributed to the shareholders of the water company. Says Mr. McDonnell, if the government takes it over, here's how it'll do it. The government will take over the enterprise, and it will pay the private companies in government bonds. No cash, a debt. The government promises to pay over 5, 10, or 15 years. And then he points out, we will immediately be able to lower the price of the water we deliver to every British home. Why? Because we have to recover with the prices we charge what it costs to bring the water, like a private company, what it costs to pay off the debt that the government undertook to get the private water company into the government's hands, but we don't have to raise the price to pay anybody any dividends, shareholders, because there aren't any. So we can lower the price. We don't have to charge as much as a private enterprise does, because our job as the government is to deliver the water, not to make a profit in the way a private enterprise does. We won't have any shareholders to pay off. The point is not whether you agree or disagree. The point is to understand this kind of thinking as a solution to the problems of the British economy is becoming mainstream again, despite all the efforts, to demonize and dismiss this approach, this kind of thinking, both in England and the United States, for many decades now. The wind, the economic and political wind, is changing. The final economic update that we will have time for today has me listening closely to the budget director for President Trump, a man named Mulvaney. Some of you may have heard some of the things he says. Here's what he admitted over the last few days, publicly. Yes, he said, it's true, we cut taxes dramatically, $1 trillion or more. Yes, it's true, he said. On top of that, we're spending more money, $300-400 billion more. And yes, he said, if you put together a massive tax cut together with a massive increase in spending, obviously the only way the government can do that is if it borrows the money it's no longer raising in taxes to spend even more than it was spending before. And then he makes the interesting admission that I want to make sure you all understand. Speaking as if he were explaining this to children, Mr. Mulvaney says, yes, of course, if suddenly the government has to borrow $1 trillion that it didn't have to borrow before the tax cut, that's going to drive up interest rates because the government's going to have to persuade people to lend it money, even though the government is more in debt now than it has been for decades. What is Mr. Mulvaney telling us? He's telling us that we can expect to see, now his words, interest rate spikes. Well, folks, there's the admission. If the interest rates spike up, the cost of buying a home shoots up because that's what shapes a mortgage. The cost of buying a car shoots up because of the interest over the years you take to pay off the car. Ditto for your credit card, ditto for your students' college borrowing. Wow. Turns out that cutting taxes for corporations and the rich and spending more on the Defense Department is going to whack you right in your pocketbook. That part was left out in all the debates and all the discussion. Mr. Mulvaney, after the fact, smilingly lets us know. You live in a system that doesn't work for you. And part of my job is to make sure it doesn't blow by you without your being aware of it. We've reached the end of the first half of this program. Thank you very much for listening. Please stay with us as we move to a very interesting interview about a very important part of the global economy. Stay right with us. We'll be right back.
And you've been listening to Enlightened Radio here in the Moose Turd Cafe. My name is John Case, and we're doing some surveys of the landscape here. And we're going to actually pause on that particular dude right there for now. And take a look at another short interview here with that the Belabored, which is a by Dissent, which is a publication out of the Democratic Socialists of America, which has recently grown, very large, kind of the I think a combination of the Trump presidency waking a bunch of people up and the reality TV. So-called presidency, and of course Bernie Sanders' campaign, in which he openly declared himself as a socialist and pursuing a program, not a little bit left, not much of Franklin Roosevelt, what used to be called liberal, and now I guess gets tagged or called socialist. But one of the reasons I'm going to do more of Richard Wolff and have more discussion is that, what's the impulse towards socialism, what it really means, and if it means any one thing, I probably does not, but what we're searching for, in that reaction to some aspects of the capitalism, which is a more or less market driven economic decision maker, let's call it that for now, and the relative, what does it mean in the struggle over what parts of society are publicly financed and what parts are not, and of course there's many ideologies that arise out of these out of the turbulence, if nothing else, in market relations. So, and in the technological development, which what's the right word? The markets make it possible for technologies to replace older, new technologies to replace older ones faster than a previous economic systems did. And it's, matter of fact, sometimes it's hard to tell, it's like a chicken or the egg argument, whether or not the technologies gave birth to capitalism or capitalism gave birth to the technologies. It's, you can go all the way back and still, you know, have an argument that can't be easily resolved as to what generated what. And technology makes certain kinds of labor more productive, okay? And that labor might not be a kind of labor that fits nicely in the inherited economic system. You could say if you were in the midst of the Middle Ages, well, you were a serf, you know, a person who tilled the land for some portion of what you produced, and the rest of it would be to the lord or the feudal regime, the church in many cases, the Catholic Church if you're in Europe. And it took different forms in different societies, but a very rigid, more or less rigid class structure that, you know, when you do one thing, and as well as your children, and we do another. And of course, you know, the rise of armaments and the rise of trading by the lords who had some surplus. But what are they going to do with it? If it was just a surplus of corn, well, what are they going to trade the corn for? You know, they saw some passing guy from Asia with diamonds on his fingers. They like to have them. But why would the guy from Asia take the corn? Sure, I'll give you 40 bushels of corn for 10 diamonds. That kind of thing. So you ended up having those kind of problems, which gave rise to the desire to change and make it easier to do these transactions, which became, at first, they were a very small part of the economy, but over the time, they became bigger and bigger. And at a certain point, they became incompatible with the you know, rigid social relations of the feudal system. And we may be seeing something like that happen again, only on a totally different framework, really, and you shouldn't, you know, make analogies too easily. But, you know, we have some incompatible relationships going on in society now. Partly just the, you know, the scale and the speed and the number of transactions that are going on both nationally and globally. It makes it very, very difficult to decide, hey, what part do I have a control over and what part do I not? And even if I don't have control, what can I? Is there, are there some stuff I can't even influence? You know, that's another toughie, you know, to answer there. All right, so we're going to go and do. I'm going to do a belabored by descent here. Let me clear out this particular thing here and well, okay, Mr. Podcast, where are you? I have to find things. See, only my engineer and me and the host are the same thing here. So we don't want that. New. No. We want a piece. P podcast and belabor it. And here we go. Let's see.
To Descent Magazine's Belabored Podcast, hosted by Sarah Jaffe and Michelle Chen.
Hey, Sarah.
Hi, Michelle.
And welcome to episode 145 of Belabored. We are talking in this episode to organizer and writer Sean Richman about the state of labor and what unions can do to protect themselves and move forward under Trump. But first, the news. Across the industrialized world, you can expect that if you're a worker and you just had a baby or are caring for a desperately ill loved one at home or suffer a medical crisis, you can get time off of your job. And indeed, the law actually protects your right to paid leave, but the U.S. stands alone in not providing workers any protections for a single day of paid leave. So this year, the Family Medical Leave Act turns 25 years old, and it's showing its age. This is the Clinton-era law that protects your right to a few weeks of unpaid leave from work to deal with medical circumstances or some sort of family medical emergency or need. Though many workers do qualify for limited unpaid family leave thanks to this and other laws, the process for qualifying for it is restricted and highly bureaucratic, and currently just 15% of formerly employed workers have paid leave through an employer-based program. It's critical for closing the gender pay gap that parents are able to take time off to care for their kids without having to suffer a pay penalty for it. Currently, millions of private sector workers have virtually no legal guarantee of paid or unpaid leave. The issue of paid leave has been dead on arrival in Washington for years, but increasingly cities and states are moving ahead of the feds by instituting payroll-based paid leave programs, which allow for a nominal tax on your wages, similar to the Social Security tax that then goes into a fund that later supports income reimbursement for you and other workers taking long-term leave. So you might get about 75% of your normal pay during 12 weeks that you take off to take care of a newborn, for example. It helps me. So far, California, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and most recently New York have instituted statewide paid leave programs, which have supported many, many families over the years. It's been taken hundreds of thousands of times. And now there's renewed optimism for the proposed Federal Family and Medical Insurance Leave Act. That's the Family Act. It would provide a nationwide family leave program. It would cost about $1.50 deduction from your weekly paycheck, and in return, you'd be able to take time off to care for your family or deal with a personal medical issue while still receiving up to 2/3 of your regular income. And unlike the Family Medical Leave Act, the program would cover all families, including LGBTQ and adoptive parents, and also cover a wider variety of sectors and even regularly employed workers or self-employed people. Even the Trump administration these days and the Republicans are proposing their own watered-down paid leave programs, so things seem to be looking up in Washington for legislation like this. But at a time when we're seeing massive cuts to Medicaid and other social programs, expanding health protections at work needs much deeper reforms than just the tax breaks and voluntary measures that conservatives typically emphasize. The time to take care of yourself and your family is priceless, and the least your boss could do is make sure that you don't have to pay a penalty at work for taking it.
As I'm recording this, teachers across West Virginia are on strike, a statewide strike, despite the state not having collective bargaining rights for those teachers. We will have much more on this next episode, so stay tuned. But last episode, I talked about the strike vote taken by the St. Paul Federation of Teachers in St. Paul, Minnesota, who were preparing for a showdown with administrators and the local government over steadily shrinking school budgets and other working conditions. Well, it came down to the wire, but they won a settlement that includes restorative practices in schools, guaranteed recess, new English language learner teachers and special education support, class size caps, opt-outs for standardized testing, and most importantly, a joint agreement with the district to seek additional tax funding and other funding sources to fund programs to make the district more equitable. I talk with St. Paul Federation of Teachers President Nick Faber about their win and how it happened.
So we actually, with our group of parents and community members and educators, members, we created this team called our Tiger Team, which stood for Teaching and Inquiring into Greed, Equity, and Racism. Uh-huh. And that team actually took on just some small corporate actions, right? So we did anything from taking a few of our members and parents to a place where Richard Davis from US Bank was speaking for a chamber event and getting a table for that. Right up front, and actually during the Q&A, saying, you know, a Q&A after he had spent most of the time speaking about how he had leveraged millions and millions of private dollars to bring the Super Bowl to town. So to actually get up after that and say, look, you're a powerful dude. You can leverage millions and millions of dollars to bring a game to town that most of our kids aren't going to be able to see. How about using that same power to sit down at the table with us and figure out how we can leverage millions of dollars for St. Paul Public Schools and the schools that St. Paul children deserve? And he agreed to meet with us publicly right there. We got him on camera, and then we got the wild goose chase of never ending being passed from secretary to secretary and never actually ending up sitting down with Richard Davis, but did sit down with three members of U.S. Bank and three of our members to actually talk about what this might look like. And we know, and partially why we're asking you as a big business to lobby with us, is because we know when you guys go to the Capitol, things get done. Let's push on that together. And until that happens, here are some other ways that you could contribute to St. Paul Public Schools. And they said no. They said no very politely. But it's just like any other negotiation, right? Just like our traditional contract negotiation, that was stage one. So now we recoup and we escalate and see what we get at the next time we sit down. I think, you know, having the Super Bowl in town allowed us to work with some other partners that were working on similar means for their organization. So we were actually collectively able to lift up this nature of this game that was actually like a big party for rich folks and kind of the gross nature of it, and to highlight that these corporations that are part of the host committee can do so much more for not only our schools, but for our communities. And that was really powerful to be able to support each other in that nature. So, and especially, you know, on the 29th, which was kind of the launch of the week prior to the Super Bowl, we kicked off a rally downtown with our other Super Bowl partners, you know, a decent sized rally, and then marched over to the XL where Energy Center, where even though it was St. Paul and the Super Bowl's in Minneapolis, they were having NFL night or something like that. And, you know, essentially took the streets and showed that we can do that. We can do that with our partners and just kind of flexing some of our power a little bit. And with our new mayor in town, although we have a really good relationship with him, we just want him to know the context of where we're at here. We will strike. Right. And we can put 300 or 400 people on the street in the middle of the night on a Monday night in downtown St. Paul.
Right.
In the middle of the winter when it's really cold.
Yeah.
So, and this is interesting too, because, you know, this is the third campaign that we've been working with community, and we've been working with parents and involving them in our campaign in creative ways. And it's really dug in deep with issues that are directly related to kids, right?
Yeah.
And not so focused on our wages and benefits. Well, now all of a sudden we're getting in mainstream press an analysis of that. Not deep analysis, but it's really interesting. And also our school board is starting to raise this as well. Like, it's not really fair to make policy decisions in a contract negotiation. It's like, that should be an open process and this and that. And essentially just challenging the whole idea of bargaining for the common good. It's another just really frustrating place for us as a union, and trying to figure out how to message and work with this, because it seems like you have this narrative of greedy teachers and teachers union that just fights for wages and benefits, and when you do something different, then they tell you, no, you're supposed to stay in your lane and just only bargain for wages and benefits,
right,
so that we can put you in that spot and show you as selfish, so we can put you out of commission, essentially. And we're not going to fall on that. We're going to decide what our lane looks like.
That was Nick Faber of the St. Paul Federation of Teachers.
Now, at a time when he's weighed down by scandals and facing pressure on immigration and gun control, President Trump has once again tried to distract us by dangling before us the shiny idea of infrastructure. He rolled out a...
All right, we're going to leave the infrastructure discussion for another day and see where are we at now. Yeah, we're right about at the hour mark, and we're going to wind up this part of the program and continue on with our celebration of Black History Month. It's going to be going on for, the rest of this month. I have at least 100 hours, more than 100 hours, actually, 200 hours of John Coltrane. And it's going to be a John Coltrane. And then I have also a wonderful collection from University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, of, speeches of about an hour's length by notable African Americans in many fields over the past 70 some years, and interspiced with that some readings from W.E.B. Du Bois' turn of the century publications, which were you know, unbelievably important in the African American history and in the history of our country. And he was one of the, certainly one of the keenest observers on the need to move beyond the failures of Reconstruction. Of course, W.B. Du Bois was a world-renowned scholar and intellectual, and he was probably the strongest, one of the strongest voices for African-American freedom. And for African descendant peoples, you know, around the world, he was considered the father of many different movements, and including in Africa and in the United States. All right, so we're going to bring the Moose Turd Cafe here. Hope we've had something a little palatable for you to eat here this morning, and as you gird your loins for battle the rest of the day. We'll be back tomorrow morning, and maybe we'll take on the infrastructure and some other issues. And we're going to focus probably more heavily on economic than this purely political coming up here in the next few days, but we'll see what happens and the material that we find. Expect a live report on the teacher strike. I'm headed to the picket line here later today, and look forward at about 10 o'clock here this morning, and then again at noon we're going to be playing doing storytelling with Stepani and Stosh, and it's going to be their storytelling is just magnificent. I think Fanny, I'm actually including some of her shows in the African American History Celebration because she has some of her material is very strongly oriented in her grandparents and great grandparents who were very active in the liberation movement in the United States. And, claim a kinship or, well, not kinship, but a relationship with Frederick Douglass himself. All right, so we're going to call it quits right there, and we'll see this podcast up in just an hour or two on podcast.enlightenradio.org. This is John Case, and take care of each other. It's late, but everything comes next.